Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I am Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. The Ebola death toll in Africa has just surpassed 5,000, with the most fatalities in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and half of all deaths in Liberia, with just a few transmissions in Europe and the U.S. Today, we will speak with the world's leading creation science author, Dr. Jonathan Sarfati, to talk about what is a virus and how communicable is Ebola really as compared to other diseases. But as biblical creationists, we also ask, with God as our creator, why do viruses even exist? And also, regarding the human effort to alleviate suffering from Ebola, has the gospel of Jesus Christ made a difference there in West Africa? So, Dr. Sarfati, it's an honor to have you back on Real Science Radio.
An honor for me, too. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. You have just written a tremendous article on Ebola, looking at the disease from many different perspectives. So, could we begin with how do disease-causing pathogens arise in God's very good creation?
Well, it's so important to understand the biblical doctrine of the fall. So what was originally created to be beneficial can now cause damage. Like animals were created vegetarian. Now many animals eat other animals. So this is not the way God originally made it. Something happened in the fall. And the same happens with disease germs. It seems something has happened to them so that once they were beneficial to us, and even now we have loads of beneficial bacteria in our intestines, but sometimes the bacteria can be turned against us. And often you'll find the most dangerous bacteria are the ones that have a degenerated genome. It's been degenerated, and therefore they can't get nutrients on their own, so they have to get nutrients by attacking a more complex organism. Now, viruses are a bit different because they're not really living things. They are things that can hijack the machinery of truly living things to reproduce themselves. They can't reproduce on their own without other living things. So they can't be an intermediate between life and non-life because they have to have life to exist. But even now, there are beneficial functions for viruses. And we have a lot of beneficial viruses in nature, and they do seem to have a role even in keeping cancers down today.
So that if we look at Genesis, it seems that what you're saying, we find evidence for even in the text, because God says as a result of the fall, then in the plant kingdom, there will now be thorns and thistles.
That's one thing. And we have the whole creation groaning, as in Romans chapter 8, because Adam had dominion over the creation, so did Eve. And so when they fell, the whole creation underneath them fell, and God cursed the ground. And that would seem to be an all-inclusive curse. So everything is now not what it was originally created to be.
So that if we see a mallard duck that's suffering from an infection and dies, or horses caught up in a drought and dying of thirst, or maybe predators attacking a baby elephant, while even old earth Christians would say that that kind of thing went on for eons before Adam and Eve were created or before they sinned, the Bible suggests that all this kind of suffering, the creation itself groaning, as you quoted the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans, that that was all a result of the fall. So that when we see, for example, in the fossil record, even thorns from rose bushes, fossil thorns, the Bible says that there were no thorns until after man sinned.
Well, that's a very important problem with the old earth people. They can't escape the fact that their view puts death and disease and suffering before sin. So you have to wonder, what did the curse actually do if it didn't introduce these things? It looks like they're already suffering these things regardless of sin. And also you've got the very clear statement that humans and animals were created as vegetarian. That's Genesis 1:29-30. And the book of Isaiah in 11 and 65 points to a restoration of this Edenic state of animals once again being vegetarian, the famous lion and the calf, or the lamb and the wolf, the poisonous snake with little child leading them, and there'll be no more hurting or destroying in my holy mountain. So what we have now is hurting and destroying, but was not the way that God originally created things.
So even animal suffering, we can see that the way God created us, the Bible tells us we are body, soul, and spirit, whereas a tree, a plant, only has a body. It doesn't have a soul or a spirit, but we could actually have relationships at some level with man's best friend, the dog or a horse. Mm-hmm. And so at some level, God has put a soul in some of these creatures, and that kind of creaturely suffering is a real thing. So in God's original creation, there would have been no such suffering, but God, being brilliant as he is, made sure that if there was rebellion in the creation, that it would no longer remain a perfect paradise.
And it seems like he may have built in things into the creatures that would enable them to survive in a fallen world, and these things were these latent instructions of the DNA may have been turned on at the fall, and that's part of the changes that happened. Because, I mean, a thorn is like a modified leaf. Instead of growing flat, it curls upon itself, which is what it wants to do anyway. The leaf has to try and stop this curvature, the natural curvature on itself. And a thorn is just these controls are broken down, so curvature happens and you get the thorn. One aspect of something which is broken down, but also God, of course, knew what was going to happen, so he pre-programmed all this.
And it seems that, like, we could make an analogy for people who win a lottery and they suddenly get $30 million, mm-hmm. or they become rock stars or Hollywood mm-hmm. celebrities, and so often their relationships, their husband-wife relationships, the families break down. There's some truth to the observation that people who need one another are blessed. And so mm-hmm. God seemed to make it so that if Adam and Eve sinned, then Adam would have to struggle to survive, to provide, and he would really need his wife. He would need her, and that need for one another would help them overcome adversity in a fallen world.
Right.
So the world is a difficult place to survive, but it's not the way God had created it in the beginning. So when you said that, in fact, in your article, you quote a well-known evolutionist, Lynn Margulis,
right,
and you're talking about how a bacteria will lose a genetic information, genes, and become increasingly lethal. Could we talk first about the difference between a bacteria and a virus? You touched on it briefly, Dr. Sarfati, but I think this is an RNA virus.
That's correct, yes.
Could we just talk about that? You touch on it in your article. DNA, RNA, maybe we'll have a little tutorial for a moment.
Well, okay, the thing is, our most bacteria, right to humans, they have DNA as their information storage system. They also have a lot of machinery to help this DNA reproduce and pass on this information storage to the offspring. That's what self-reproduction is. And the DNA also codes for proteins, and it does this via another molecule called RNA. And the RNA is decoded in a machine called the ribosome, which is a protein. And, of course, the instructions to build the ribosome are on the DNA, but you need a ribosome to read those instructions. So that's a vicious circle for the origin of self-reproduction.
Right.
You need everything fully functional, otherwise it won't work.
That,
now, a virus actually skips the step of needing the reproductive machine because it's just information, almost just information. So it needs the reproductive machinery of truly living cells to reproduce. And a lot of viruses have just DNA, so you have to have something to make that into RNA so it codes for the proteins to make the virus, but it needs the other cells' machinery to do that. Now, while other viruses like the influenza and the Ebola are RNA viruses. Okay. Now, RNA is actually a very unstable molecule. I mean, it's not going to arise in a primordial soup. It's just too unstable.
It's even more unstable than DNA.
Very much so,
and
yes.
DNA has even just recently, the half-life of DNA has been published in the scientific literature.
Mm.
Could you give us an idea of how long DNA would last once an organism has died?
Well, there's a paper by Alan Toft, who's, I think, a Swedish biochemist, who measured the breakdown rate of DNA at various temperatures, concluded that even if you deep froze it to -5 Celsius, it wouldn't last. It would last 6.8 million years, and that would be totally gone.
So
totally
that's if it's
fragmented.
That's if it's frozen.
Yes.
So in Fahrenheit, below in the 20s.
About 23, I think, yeah.
And so we are now finding, and this is being published in the peer-reviewed literature from a hadrosaur and a Tyrannosaurus rex, evidence of DNA. It is decomposed. They haven't been able to sequence it, but there are histone proteins that the DNA is wrapped around.
Mm-hmm.
And so it appears that we actually have DNA from at least two different species of dinosaurs. And so if they were to be millions of years old, this published half-life of DNA says, well, that'd be impossible, even if they were frozen all that time, which they were not.
Right. And also the thing is, Mary Schweitzer used three different tests to find DNA in the dinosaur, and the test called DAPI has to lodge in a double, one of the grooves of a double helix. So it means there must be a lot of DNA so it can actually form a double helix.
Wow.
So a double helix was actually there in the dinosaur bones, otherwise the test wouldn't have found it.
Wow. So, and we've done a lot of reporting on Dr. Mary Schweitzer's work and dinosaur soft tissue. And so that's an exciting field. In fact, we're producing a video on that in December. Yeah. If they lose the dinosaurs, they lose it all. Because Dr. Sarfati, they have spent decades trying to convince millions of kids that dinosaurs prove that the Bible's not true, that an atheistic scientific worldview has the truth. Well, if science shows, as it is showing, that dinosaurs are young. They have soft tissue, DNA, carbon-14, left-handed amino acids. This is all powerful evidence that we should take the Bible's chronology literally.
Well, I think DNA is turning the evolutionist's best witnessing tool against the evolutionists themselves and taking it over for whom it really belongs, the creationists, who really have the proper explanation for dinosaurs. And unfortunately, I do come across people who are told by misguided pastors that dinosaurs were either a hoax from the devil or a man-made hoax, which is complete nonsense,
because
they are really something on our side.
Right. In fact, the latest discovery of Dreadnoughtus, an enormous dinosaur that makes a T-Rex look like a rodent. And when God writes of Behemoth in the book of Job, and God is sort of bragging about his ability as a creator, and perhaps we've now discovered the actual species of Behemoth. Perhaps it was Dreadnoughtus.
I believe so, because the description even says that this 30-foot-long tail, they describe it as a weaponized tail. And when you think of a behemoth having a tail like a cedar, that fits the Dreadnoughtus perfectly. I think it would just swat a T-Rex like a fly with that enormous tail.
Yeah, and how silly to compare it, as some have done, to a rhinoceros or an elephant with their tails. And in fact, Mary Schweitzer is working on the bones of Dreadnoughtus to look for soft tissue. That's thrilling, that development. I believe the discoverer of Dreadnoughtus has said that it was a vegetarian. And when I read in the book of Job, it describes this creature that the animals of the field, they sort of play around it like they're not afraid of being eaten by it. So that's another exciting aspect of that discovery. But so we're talking about DNA and RNA being very complex molecules that break down very rapidly. So finding DNA in dinosaur bones is powerful evidence that they're young, sort of like Egyptian mummy age in that range, not millions of years old. But to get back to Ebola then, and the Ebola virus, which that's the scientific term for it, Ebola virus, one word, the idea that life could arise naturally by a virus, perhaps, you've already pointed out very briefly, but to drive the point home for the audience, a virus can't be an intermediary. It's more simple than a bacteria or a single-celled organism. Yes, it's more simple, but it requires other living organisms to exist.
Exactly. That's a very important point. It can't exist on its own. It can't reproduce on its own.
And so, therefore, a system that involves a virus is more complex than a single-celled living organism. So the evolutionists really have no way to go using a virus as an explanation of how life arose. But then you mentioned the RNA world. Many of them will say, well, DNA is, of course, wildly complicated. So perhaps life arose via RNA. And so your point on that is RNA is even more unstable than DNA.
Let's see, deoxyribose, you see, compared to ribo, means that deoxyribonucleic acid has one less hydroxyl group, and that means that there's one less place for chemicals to attack the sugar backbone of the nucleic acid. So RNA has an extra source of attack. So my colleague, Dr. Rob Card, has worked with DNA, and he says, with DNA, you've got to freeze it really quickly. RNA, don't even bother because it's just too unstable.
Oh, wow. And when DNA researchers, when they do freeze, which they have to freeze their specimens to work on them, they bring them to a pretty cold temperature, don't they?
Very much so. And even that is not enough to stop breakdown. I mean, you've got this embryos put in cold storage. That can't happen indefinitely because DNA is going to be breakdown even at those cold storage temperatures over time.
So we find this dinosaur DNA in sandstone in Montana. And so, obviously, that sandstone was not frozen for millions of years.
Well, dinosaurs are meant to live in tropical climates as well. So, I mean, of course, in tropical type of temperatures, you're talking about a lifetime of about 22,000 years at 25 Celsius. So that is quite warm, not even tropical, but even only a matter of thousands of years at that sort of temperature, let alone millions, is just not possible.
Right. Okay. So that was, we sort of took that rabbit trail of the question of a biogenesis and does a virus help solve the problem for the atheist as to how did life arise? And it doesn't.
Absolutely.
But now perhaps we could go back to Ebola. So back to Ebola, the transmission rates of the Ebola virus compared to other pathogens, how easily does Ebola spread?
Okay, you need to have contact with the body fluid to spread it. That's what they're saying. And apparently one Ebola-affected person infects two other people. So we talk about this term called R-naught, which is the average number of people that a sick person will infect. Now, so it's about 2 for Ebola, but when you're talking about mumps, it's about 10. And measles is incredibly contagious because that has an R-naught of about 18. So in days gone by, one person sick with measles would infect 18 others. So that would spread like wildfire. While Ebola would not be spread so much, but still, I wouldn't want to be too close to an Ebola patient without proper protective gear.
Right. So it's not as communicable. But of course, a virus can mutate. And as they mutate, the Ebola virus is named, as you point out, after the Ebola River in the Congo.
Yep.
And the current outbreak in West Africa, researchers they've sequenced the RNA of the virus, and they've said this is actually a different strain of the virus than what they've seen in the Congo. And so it could mutate, and in mutating further, as you mentioned earlier, it could become even more lethal. So,
It seems like originally, like the flu virus seems to be begun as a benign virus in ducks, you see. This is the H1N1 flu, which has caused the Spanish flu epidemic. And it seems that the Ebola seems to live in fruit bats. And it seems to actually may even do them some good by promoting repair machinery that destroys tumors. So bats don't seem to get cancer because you've got these viruses really pushing the repair machines to correct the damage genes that might cause cancer. So it means that they actually do a beneficial job in bats, but coming to humans who aren't designed to cope with the Ebola virus, they start to do very much a lot of damage to our own organs.
Thankfully, it is not as communicable as mumps or measles or certain other diseases, but the lethality of it, the fatality rate is terribly high. It's just up over 70% in Africa. And so
you definitely don't want to get it. Yeah,
it's so horrific. The symptoms, the bleeding, internal and external bleeding, and the vomiting, and it's just horrific. So that the suffering, the human suffering, is just so severe. Could we talk about two aspects of that? One we've already touched on, and it is the question of suffering that so many atheists will say because there's suffering, there cannot be a biblical God. The God of the Bible can't be real because of the problem of suffering. But then also, has the gospel of Jesus Christ made a difference there in West Africa? So first, the problem of evil, the problem of suffering. Dr. Sarfati, you've heard that question often. How do you respond to
that? I've even written a book with an article on the whole thing. But the big picture reason is that all death and suffering is a result of sin. In particular, it was Adam's sin that brought death and suffering into the whole creation. So that's the big picture answer to all those questions. So it's Adam's sin that's responsible, which means he couldn't have had this happening for millions of years before sin. It's not biblically possible. But also the Bible is very clear that alleviating the effects of the curse is a blessing. Jesus, when he came to earth, God incarnate, he cured disease, he raised the dead, cured people with disabilities. So he is undoing some of the effects of the curse. So he sets an example for us to try to help people who are suffering, especially the effects of the curse. And it looks like the people who are right at the forefront in treating Ebola are Christian missionary doctors. And the atheists are very annoyed about that, about Christian missionaries basically doing all the work. But then they have to admit, well, where are the atheists doing all this work?
Well, where are the atheists? You point out that the founding of orphanages and hospitals, the heroes who fought to abolish slavery, like William Lloyd Garrison in the U.S. and William Wilberforce in England, these men were driven by their conviction that men are made in God's image and God's likeness and therefore free. Well, in Africa, so fast forward from then a couple hundred years till today, and you have Christians fighting Ebola in Africa in a way that shows the grace and mercy of Jesus Christ.
And also at risk to their own lives, because some of the people who have been at the forefront, the Christian missionary doctor like Kent Brantley, actually got Ebola for his troubles. I mean, he managed to survive, thank goodness, but it's interesting how it's the Christians who are at the forefront, and atheists are admitting that that's where we are reliant on these missionary doctors and nurses.
So
we can't escape that.
I don't know if you have your article handy, but you have some amazing quotes of atheists acknowledging the missionaries in Africa and their need. Could you share some of those with us?
See, Brian Palmer, who's an atheist, he says he's an atheist. He's writing in a very left-wing publication called Slate. He's saying, like it or not, we are deeply reliant on missionary doctors and nurses. 30% of healthcare facilities are run by religious entities, and the missionaries don't profit personally from their work. They're compensated very poorly, if at all. Many risk their lives. How many people risk death to spread the gospel of Western consumer goods?
Right. And so he says, as an atheist, I truly believe Africa needs God.
That was Michael Paris in England, who is talking about Africa in general. And he, again, an atheist who's seen the beneficial effects of Christianity in Africa.
So
and other thing, people, other worldviews are just not producing these benefits.
And thank
only
you,
Christianity.
Thank you for distinguishing between those two atheists. So there are atheists who are acknowledging what Christians are doing in the name of the Lord there in Africa, and even pointing out they're risking their lives, and for obviously no financial benefit. Missionaries typically are reimbursed very poorly. We support a Grace Gospel missions effort out of Indianapolis, and those missionaries, they live at the poverty level. We love these guys. Jeremy and Andrea Clark have lived in Costa Rica, but they've not gotten wealthy. They're there because of Jesus said to love your neighbor.
That's right.
Dr. Sarfati, could we talk a bit about this article on Ebola, and how could you explain a virus, a pathogen in a Christian worldview? This is one of thousands of articles on a website called creation.com. It is run by the organization that you're a part of, CMI, Creation Ministries International. Could you tell us a bit about CMI? And I'm just so encouraged by your work. So,
well, thank you. Yeah, Creation Ministries International has been going for 35 years. It has offices in 7 countries, and I think it employs more scientists than any other Christian organization. We have a website with almost 10,000 articles to try to help Christians defend their faith and understand the Bible can be trusted right from the very first verse. And one of our exciting new projects is a video and book called Evolution's Achilles Heels, where you have loads of PhD scientists showing that evolution just doesn't stand up. It's got loads of fatal weaknesses in all sorts of different areas.
When I have a question of apologetics, the defense of the gospel, creation, evolution, when someone is challenging a historical claim in the Bible, I have three websites that I go to first, and I won't name the other two right now, but one of the three is creation.com. It's a treasure for the world. And any Christian who is concerned about their neighbor and providing an answer for those who ask about the hope that is within us, every Christian needs to become familiar with creation.com and how to find answers to common questions on that website. So, Dr. Sarfati, you travel the U.S. Do you get out of the country often?
Not too often. The last time would have been to Canada for the Canadian Creation Conference in August, but mainly my work is now in the United States. I've been living here for 4.5 years. I have an American wife and 2 American granddaughters, so I'm here to stay for the foreseeable future.
I have visited the country you were raised in, New Zealand, right? You're from New Zealand.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been there. Love it. Auckland, New Zealand. I went there when Bill Clinton went there.
Oh, okay.
Not to honor him, but to call attention to his failures.
Oh, and, plenty of those.
Which are horrific. And his opposition to God as our creator, of course. And by the way, when we were there, we really did make an impact on the country. Radio, newspapers, TV. Good. I think it was TV One or News One. I forget the name of the stations there. We did reach the country. There were 10 of us there for a week.
Wow.
Yeah. But you were the chess champion, right? The national chess champ of New Zealand?
I was chess champion of the whole of the country, yes.
And I've not been at an event where you have played multiple opponents simultaneously, but you do that and you play blindfolded, right?
I sometimes play blindfolded, which means playing from memory and understand every square on the chessboard has a letter and a number. So you can communicate which piece goes to what square. And that someone has to tell me that, and I have to tell them what I'm playing. But I keep the positions in my head, basically. That's what I'm doing there.
Well, I tried my hand at chess as a teenager read Bobby Fischer's book, My 60 Most Memorable Games.
Good book.
Two games in that book were against Samuel Reshevsky, and he lived nearby me. He lived in New York. I was in New Jersey. So I would go to his house once a week for lessons. And I tried playing blindfolded, and I could get up to about 15, 16 moves into the game, and then I'd fall apart. So I didn't have what it takes, Dr. Sarfati, but I could.
Which often, if you're playing a lot of games simultaneously, it's the opening moves that are the hardest to go through because the important thing is to get the games distinct. So often it's the opening moves that are the hardest.
Oh, my.
More pieces involved.
Wow. So your books, is this a stat that is ever mentioned publicly? If not, that's fine. But your books have sold so many copies. I mentioned that you are the best-selling creation author, at least as far as I'm aware. Could you give us an idea of how...
I think my first book, Refuting Evolution, which was originally published in 1999 to refute the National Academy of Sciences Teacher's Guidebook on Evolution, that has about 500,000 copies sold.
Oh, my. Wow. One of your latest books was a response to Richard Dawkins' The Greatest Show on Earth.
That's correct. My book was called The Greatest Hoax on Earth.
Yes.
And coming up is my commentary on Genesis 1 to 11, and that, God willing, is due around Christmas time.
Wow. Well, thank you, Dr. Sarfati, for joining us on Real Science Radio. What an honor to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you for having me again, Pastor.
You're very welcome. That was Dr. Jonathan Sarfati with CMI, Creation Ministries International. And that article that we've been talking about, you can find it online at creation.com. And all you need to do is just search there for Ebola, or you could do creation.com/Ebola-fall. Of course, we'll link to it from our website, realscienceradio.com. And we have an abbreviation, rsr.org. And if you like what we're doing, please help us out by going to our store and purchasing some science materials here in Denver. I will be presenting a global flood seminar at the historic Brown Palace Hotel, downtown Denver, November 29th. It's $20 a person, $30 a family, Saturday 9 to 4. We'll have a great time talking about the global flood. This is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.